Hi everyone and welcome back to The Advice Show. I'm Zach, a reporter at New Model Advisor, and today we're talking about acquisitions, how they work, and what stops a deal going over the line. Joining me today is Dominic Rose, CEO at MKC Wealth. Dom, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Now, Dom, you've acquired, you know, over 100 firms, leading acquisitions at Quilter, Bell Penny, and Towergate Financial. You know, in all that experience, what were the most common reasons deals fell through? Talk us through your frustrations.
The frustrations. Well, I think if we talk about once a deal's been agreed, some of the most common reasons why they fall over is usually if something comes to light during the DD phase. So if something comes to light that either party wasn't aware of. So what that means is it's absolutely critical to be really transparent up front before a deal is agreed as to how it's going to work, what's going on in your business if you're the business owner who's looking to sell, or if you're the acquiring a party. What are you going to do with the business post-deal? How is it all going to be integrated, for example? So it's where if there's a surprise during the process, this is one of those situations where nobody likes surprises. Right. So far better to make sure that everybody's completely upfront and transparent, because otherwise there's a loss of trust. And really, the whole process is built on trust. They also can fall over if one side tries to change a deal. So actually, if somebody tries to change a deal term or some aspect of the transaction changes, if it moves away from the fundamental principles that were agreed at the start, again, trust falls over and therefore a deal falls over. One of the other sort of common reasons are something called deal fatigue, okay, which, yeah, just without that sort of headline, it's basically everyone gets bored, right? So if it takes too long, it drags on, and everyone sort of just gets weary of it, and then they just drift away and they lose the appetite to do it. So deal fatigue is a real issue, and that kills them. One of the perhaps more practical tips I can give is if a business owner appoints a lawyer who's got no experience in financial services.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Incredibly painful. And that's because of the many frustrating nuances around our sector. And you end up spending lots of time with a lawyer who doesn't understand the sector trying to explain all of the nuances of the sector. And it's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. They try and implement things into a transaction agreement that's not really required or relevant to the sector. So one of the strongest tips I would give to anybody who's looking at, you know, selling their business is to, if you do, once you've agreed a deal, appoint a lawyer who's got financial services experience.
I was just going to say, I imagine that's quite a roadblock because, you know, a lot of the time it's just spent educating a lawyer, as it were. That's interesting. It's quite a surprising thing I hadn't considered before.
Yeah. And also because lawyers approach these things with a healthy skepticism. So actually where you're trying to reassure them, actually, this is fairly normal for this kind of a transaction. A lawyer who's advising a business owner will approach that with skepticism and may not believe it and try and focus on points that don't need to be focused on. And that's another really important point, actually, is that as part of the process, you've got the principals who've agreed to do something and they know what the original premise of a deal is and what they're both trying to achieve. That can get lost a bit in the process when you get various people in, various third parties doing due diligence and putting their 2 cents in. The skeptic might say some of them are just trying to earn their fees. I think that's not always the case, but sometimes there might be points where people are trying to point score and win something on behalf of either the buyer or the seller that actually neither party really care about.
Right? And I suppose all that does is contribute to deal fatigue, right?
Yeah, it does. But it also sows this sort of seed of doubt and people start arguing over points that really don't matter, actually. So which is what really important is that the two principals who are leading the transaction from buyer and the seller's perspective know what they're trying to achieve, have to rein in the respective advisors on each side, the DD people, make sure that you haven't got people asking stupid questions that no one really cares about, because otherwise it just winds everybody up.
And, you know, all deals are different, but on generally speaking, you know, those points that don't matter that, it can be a danger to focus on. Can you give an insight into your experience of those things that maybe too much importance is given to and it just slows a deal up?
Yeah, there'll be points that will come out of due diligence typically. So, you know, if you're doing financial DD, for example, and and the financial DD partner wants to go down the rabbit hole of whether VAT is applicable on advice charges, for example, and then you start arguing back and forth as to whether that applies on a transaction in respect to the purchase of assets or not. And really, everybody who's been in the sector for long enough knows the rules around. They know what applies and what doesn't. And you just end up going down a rabbit hole and wasting money. And it requires both sides to sort of tell both advisors, actually, and say, look, guys, we don't care about this. Okay, this is okay. We know what we're doing here. Just crack on and please deliver the deal that we've both agreed between us. So there's quite a lot of management of people involved to try and get the deals over the line. But fundamentally, they fall over in the main where there's a loss of trust. Okay, and if something comes to light that the other side wasn't aware of, or if somebody tries to change something, because the whole process is built on trust.
Yeah, and I suppose it's trying to just getting your ducks in a row before the acquisition process even begins, right? In that spirit, how well generally do you think that IFAs are in terms of their preparation for the acquisition process? Could it be better, and what do they sort of what do they often miss out on?
Yeah, it actually. This is a really unhelpful answer, but it depends entirely on how they're being advised. So actually, some people who will appoint somebody to help them and guide them through the process will spend a lot of time with the business owner making sure they're actually ready. Now, ready it's in two areas, really. It's not just making sure that you've got all of the data and the information on your business, because actually, if you don't have all of that really boring MI stuff, actually, it creates a loss of confidence.
Right.
But there's the other element, which is whether a business owner is emotionally ready. Now, this is something that people often underestimate the significance of, and I have a tendency to labor the point with people, and it comes across like I'm trying to put people off doing a deal, which is not the case. I'm actually just trying to get people to realize that if you're the entrepreneurial business owner and you've been running a business for years, and you've built a business up over 20, 30 years, and actually you've been attracted by the prospect of doing a deal with somebody, it's really important to understand that there is going to be a loss of control, typically, for that individual post-deal. And for an entrepreneurial business owner, that can be really difficult. So actually, they could be blinded, to the wrong word, but distracted by realizing the capital for what they've built and all of their hard work, which is right. But then it's the practical realities of what life is like post-deal that is really important for them to consider. And for some people, that moving into an environment where they no longer can make a decision in the morning and see it implemented by lunch, right? Don't underestimate the significance of that impact.
And I suppose it's difficult for the acquirer, right? Because a lot of times you want that experience in the room post-deal for maybe a couple of years, but you don't necessarily want, obviously, them running the ship as they used to.
Yeah, it's and it comes on to an integration point, right? As to how you're going to integrate. And it's about, I think it's fine and it works really well as long as everybody's really upfront from the outset. Where these things don't work is if actually somebody's been sold a dream. Right? So if you're a business owner and you've met somebody who's selling you a dream in respect, look, here's a big check. Don't worry, nothing's going to change. You're still going to be able to carry on doing everything like you were doing before. It's just not true. In the vast majority of cases, that's just not true. Things will change. And it will depend on the extent of an integration as to the operation integration, the proposition integration, the way in which the team are integrated. But there will be change. And one of those big changes is that loss of control point for a business owner as well. So they work well as long as everybody's completely up front, right at the start of the process, and say, well, I really labor the point, what is life going to be like on a day-to-day? Once I've gone through the excitement phase and I've had some money, and the team have all joined another firm and they're all energized about it, that can wane as the practical realities of what day-to-day life is like in a different environment. So it's really important that everybody's clear on what that is right from the outset.
Yeah, and just getting into the due diligence point again, just to clear that up, I wondered what your thoughts were on an increasing regulatory climate. I'm thinking particularly about all the British Steel DB transfer history we've seen in the last few years and how that's affected acquisition processes. Do you think acquirers or firms getting more are more aware of these things and look out for them more? I'm thinking particularly, for example, Quilter CEO Paul Feeney at the time told us that Quilter had failed on its due diligence in the Lighthouse deal, for example. And I wondered if sort of industry moves like that had affected things and the way that acquisitions get passed.
Yeah, I think people have certainly tightened up their due diligence. And if they haven't, they certainly should. But yeah, people have tightened up their due diligence process. But actually what we find, what I'm seeing quite a lot of now is where there is DB exposure, irrespective of whether it's British Steel or not, people are just saying, actually, you know what, we don't want any DB exposure at all. So quite often people are discounting buying businesses because there is a past DB exposure. Now, that's a bit of a crude assessment, because actually the reality is it's around how exposed is a firm. So yeah, some buyers will say, right, you've done some DBs, no, we won't do a deal with you. Others will say, okay, you've done some, but it's a fairly small number. We'll do a lot of due diligence on them. They'll probably check every single file in respect to DB advice.
Right.
And so the outcome is likely to be that, which is always the way, fine, we think the advice is probably all right, but actually there are gaps in your files that you're going to have to spend time filling in over a period of time post-completion or sometimes pre-completion. Or there could be a situation where there'll be some firms who've got more of a risk appetite, either more willing to accept the risk around DBs, but there's very few of those. And what we do find is that people tend to actually structure transactions differently to compensate for the risk. So where firms have got a significant DB exposure, people would tend not to want to buy the share capital in that business, and they would only buy the assets from that business. And then they'd require a business owner to make sure that they've got full PI insurance covering those past liabilities, and maybe you need to leave some of the capital in the business to help cover any potential claims that may arise.
Yeah, and also that, you know, speaks to the business model of the firm acquiring and what kind of deal they want to do. I wondered if you could talk us through some different acquisition models. You know, we often see acquirers either simply trying to scale up, aggregating as many assets as possible, or the sort of more selective buy and build approach. Could you walk us through how these both work and the sort of differing objectives of both?
Yeah, integration or lack of integration is going to be one of the key points here. So I think there are a number of people out there who are acquiring as much as possible. But actually it becomes sort of a loose affiliation of IFA businesses. And what they're relying on in their model is that they're relying on a multiple arbitrage. Okay, so what I mean by that is actually they're relying on the price they pay for a business for a smaller firm being lower than the multiple valuation of a larger business.
Right.
So yes, they're not really doing any integration. They're not necessarily adding any specific value. There will be varying degrees. Some will have layers of integration, but at one end of the spectrum, it will simply be a multiple arbitrage play where they're buying at one multiple. They think the combined value of the broader group is worth a different multiple, right? And that's how they generate their return. And this is a really important point for everybody to think about when they're considering selling their business. How is the buyer generating their return here? Are all of our interests aligned? Okay, so that's just that's one model. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, you will have firms who it's a 100% integration, right? So they will acquire 100% integration, right, sort of from completion, and everything becomes the acquiring firm. Okay, and they're not reliant on that sort of multiple arbitrage opportunity, but they're bringing everybody in to follow a consistent process. Now, that's certainly my preferred approach, and it's what we do, but we're not acquiring in any sort of great volume. And to build on your point, you've got those that are doing massive volumes of transactions. I think that exposes quite a lot of risk of those firms potentially falling over because you can't digest it. Right?
Yeah.
And you can't then, even if you're not really integrating from a proposition perspective or a brand perspective even, they might be integrating various sort of central functions like finance, HR, compliance. But actually the volume of that means that some of these firms can fall over. And it's something I'm really concerned about in the industry generally, because people who've built up businesses over 20, 30 years, and this is their life's work, they're relying on the fact that actually they're going to get their payments, the clients are going to be happy, and it's all going to work. So it's such an important part of the process to make sure it's being done right on the integration. And if the plan is there is no integration, if that's what's been sold to a business owner, I'd be skeptical about it personally, on the basis that at some point, somebody's going to want to look at it and say, where's the value here? There should be more value in terms of more than just a multiple arbitrage opportunity. Does that make sense, Zach, or not?
No, it does. No, it absolutely does. And I wanted to expand on that point of integration a little bit. I wondered if you think a lack of integration also poses a problem with Consumer Duty, bringing that in for a moment. You know, building up businesses with different fee models, different IT systems, lots of investment propositions. I wonder if the regulator would point at that all and say, how does it all offer fair value?
Yeah, I think absolutely Consumer Duty does shine a light on the underlying issue, right? So I think Consumer Duty is really important. But in terms of when these firms are acquiring, if you're not aligning a fee model, And the availability of data is crucial as part of Consumer Duty. So in order to test how you're performing against each of the outcomes, you need to have the data. And actually, if you're not then integrating all of the firms and all the businesses into one consistent area for data, how can you actually report against the Consumer Duty outcomes? So you've got that element in terms of reporting against it. But then you've got a more important element, which is if I'm a client in firm X that's under the umbrella of an acquirer, but then I go and see another advisor who's come joined from another firm, and I get a similar service, but I'm charged a different fee. And that's the fundamental issue, and that's what needs to be addressed as part of the integration of acquired firms. Is there an alignment of service propositions? Is there if the fees are increasing, is there an enhancement in the service the clients are going to be receiving, and is it consistent across the firm? And I think that's one of the big problems that firms who are not integrated.
Yeah, and on that point of Consumer Duty as well, I wondered your thoughts on how, if at all, it'll change the acquisition process. I mean, you know, we've already seen some firms say that, for example, the greater focus on value for fees means that their entire business model might have to change. I wondered what you thought the process of acquisition, how that process, will be changed.
Yeah, well, it depends on, frankly, what firms' existing process is. Quite a few years ago now, quite early on, you know, when you first do these sort of deals, you make mistakes and you get it wrong and then you learn. I mean, if you're not learning, then you're definitely doing something wrong. But one of the things that we did and what I've done over the years is we do a really clear assessment of the client's current service and service and advice proposition and investment proposition versus ours. And how does the segmentation of the existing clients work versus ours? What's going to be the differential for the clients coming through that process? But this is something that you don't do post-acquisition. This is done actually before you're agreeing a deal with somebody. Okay, so before you even enter into a heads of terms, it's going to be really clear, how do the clients that are going to be joining this business, how's the service going to be impacted? How does it line up? And is there going to be a benefit to the client arising from it? Because ultimately, if there isn't a benefit from the client arising from the transaction, then it's not going to work.
Okay. Yeah.
So actually, the acquisition process, so from your, to actually answer your question, Zach, rather than just sort of ramble, it needs to be dealt with right before a deal is agreed with somebody as to absolute clarity as to how it will all align in terms of service, advice, and investment propositions. And if they don't align, a deal shouldn't be done.
Yeah. And I wondered if you thought a greater focus on integration from the regulator will mean that we'll see possibly a change in some deal prices being made, how a valuation of a firm might be affected by the fact that actually now there's a lot more pressure on us to integrate you quicker.
So I'm not sure whether that will have much of an impact on price. I think the interest rate environment and the increased cost of debt for buyers who are buying in bulk and are debt funded, that I believe has in fact impacted price. So valuations have come off the levels that they were a little bit last year. Actually, so they've reduced a bit. I think there will be a requirement for people to change some of their approaches, or at least be clearer on their approaches for integration, how they're going to align businesses under one model.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, lastly, I just wanted to talk a little bit about private equity. You know, MKC is backed by Cabo Square Capital as well. I wanted to ask you how private equity houses are different, how they can differ in terms of strategy and, you know, objectives.
Yeah. It's interesting. When we were out there, when we were raising the money for this business, I was quite clear that we have a very cautious growth plan. Because I wanted us to make sure that my fear was that growth at any cost is at the expense of client service, i.e. if you grow too fast, you're going to impact your client service, and therefore any growth is pointless, really, if you're not delivering for the clients that you're actually servicing. So finding a backer that understood that was was harder, actually, because there are quite a few PE firms out there who have got had quite a lot of capital they wanted to deploy, and they wanted to go big and fast and then sell the business on. But some of these are the ones who I think are just more interested in the multiple arbitrage opportunity rather than actually building a business for the longer term. So there's certainly some shorter term investment horizons out there, but less so perhaps, I think, now than there used to be. I think some people are seeing examples of people who've grown very quickly, failed to integrate or integrated poorly, and the impact that's actually had on the value of the business as a whole. So that's given people cause for pausing.
How long are those, generally, are those shorter term horizons? Would it be sort of 3 to 5 years?
That's been a typical horizon. Some firms invest for longer. Cabot Square with us agreed that they would invest. It was a longer investment horizon than that. As a result of the fact, we said, look, we want to build something over a longer period where everybody goes home at the end of the day actually proud about the service we've delivered rather than excited about a headline asset number. Because I think that's a little bit like vanity. Rather than actually how happy your clients are, how have each of the transactions worked. So yeah, there's definitely differing time horizons. But I do think that there's a bit of a misconception in the industry that actually all these private equity guys are there's sort of some aggressive PE people just looking for a short-term return. And actually what I've just been articulating probably didn't help. But actually, I think it's really good for the sector. The amount of investment that's coming into the sector, I think, is really good for it. Because actually what it's doing is it's driving innovation, it's driving competition, it's driving us to look at, okay, actually let's differentiate ourselves based on our service that we're delivering to clients. So I think that's a real positive. And there's lots of different firms out there who are growing through acquisition, right? And there's lots of different models, whether it's face-to-face, the digital, the hybrid, the way in which they're integrating. So if you look at it as a matrix of different models, there's going to be a type of model that's going to suit most of your listeners, but there will be the right kind of home for them. If you think about the acquisitions process and that dating stage, right, and finding the right partner to deal with, there will be that right partner. But I think actually people shouldn't be so quick to bash private equity investment in the sector when actually I do think in the longer term it's going to have a really positive impact on our industry, especially as there's learning from failed acquisition models, right? And when people take that learning, albeit that's painful learning, but when people take that on board, that will then help focus and channel the capital in the right way that will help the end client in this part of the process.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dom. That's a great answer. And lastly, I would like to ask, if you were a small IFA looking to be acquired, whether you're retiring or whatever, what would you do in your business to make yourself more attractive for acquisitions?
So I would not do anything racy, right? So this is going to be a really boring answer, I'm afraid, a really boring answer. But the reality is, and depending on the sort of type of clients that you're looking after, if we remember that actually the type of clients that we look after, these are, I'd say, sort of inverted commas, normal people whom we're responsible for looking after their life savings. Okay, so people who've built up their wealth over many years and they're entrusting us to look after it, right? So that's actually the fundamental job that we have. And is to give them good advice and to make sure that they trust us. So if you're then as a business owner, think, oh, you know what, actually I'm going to go into some racy investment over here to try and generate a couple of extra percent return, or I'm going to do anything slightly off piece for a short-term gain, actually that's going to put off any kind of buy, right? Because actually what we like is things that are vanilla. We can see that clients have been well looked after. We can see that there could be an enhancement in the service as a result of a transaction. What we don't like is lots of esoteric and off-piste stuff that basically we wouldn't then be able to replicate, but also might end up creating regulatory risk as well. So there's that element, which is keep it simple and try not to do anything racy. The other, even more boring part, is make sure that you've got the relevant data within the business, so you've got all of the information underneath it all, because otherwise that's quite a painful process. But I'd say probably the biggest point sort of brings us full circle to what I said at the start, which is business owners need to be emotionally ready. Okay, so actually when I've seen transactions fail, it's when people think they're ready to do a deal and they've been excited about a capital event. The harsh, and sometimes it is harsh, reality of life post-deal and that loss of control
Yeah.
Actually, that makes them realize, oh God, you know what? I wasn't really ready. Okay. And then they start, then things start to fall apart afterwards. So it's really important that actually you get your business in order in terms of data and all this sort of stuff, but actually make sure that you really are ready to make that decision. And there's no rushing into these things is often a mistake.
Dom, well, thank you so much. That seems like a great note to end on. Thank you so much for a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Zach. Anytime.
You've been listening to The Advice Show with myself and guest Dominic Rose, CEO at NKC Wealth. For any questions, please feel free to tweet us at New Model Advisor or email us at nmateam@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.